to a new season of the JLV Showmream podcast, made exclusively for our most generous and committed supporters.
That's what this podcast is all about. This is one way we are saying thank you to all of you who joined Showmream this year. Because of your support, Jewish Learning Venture is empowering families every day to make Judaism meaningful and relevant for themselves.
In each episode, we explore different ways Judaism impacts our lives. You can download materials for all of our episodes on our website at jewishlearningventure.org/podcast. Today, we're going to talk with Nati Passel, an innovative educator and community builder.
We are so honored to have you, Nati. Let me introduce you to our listeners. Nati Passel has been a leader in the Jewish environmental movement for the past two decades and currently works as the operations manager for Dayenu, a Jewish call to climate action. In 2005, he co-founded and served as executive director of the Jewish Farm School for 15 years, overseeing hundreds of programs for children, college students, and adults. Nati was a Joshua Venture Fellow and recognized in Jewish Week's 36 Under 36. When not working, he can be found biking, tending his garden, and sharing food with family and friends in West Philadelphia. Nati, welcome to the Jewish Learning Venture Showmream podcast.
Thanks so much. It's really a pleasure to be here.
So Nati, I know you've worked at the intersection of food justice, regenerative agriculture, and Jewish traditions for many years. Can you tell us how you got to that intersection?
Sure. When I was in college, I started working at Camp Ramah in the Poconos on the wilderness staff there. And that was kind of my entry point into the wider field of Jewish environmental education. So leading backpacking trips and rock climbing trips and things like that. And after working on that staff for three summers, when I graduated college, I went to work for the Teva Learning Center doing Jewish environmental education, primarily for sixth graders who would come up to the Isabella Friedman Jewish Retreat Center campus for 4 days in the fall. And we would take them into the woods and do all sorts of activities, teaching them both forest ecology and also Jewish perspectives on the environment and our role within it. When I was up at Teva, one of the things that I just started to get more interested in was this concept of practical environmental education. So kind of teaching the same values of sustainability and stewardship, but through teaching practical skills. I had had a bit of a background in carpentry and was starting to get into gardening. And so I thought that was a powerful way to teach some of these messages. So shortly after working at Teva for a couple seasons, along with some other folks who I met up at Isabella Friedman, people who had been Teva educators and folks from the first couple of seasons of the Adama Fellowship, we co-launched the Jewish Farm School with kind of this mission of teaching practical skills of sustainability rooted in Jewish traditions. Once I started to get more and more interested and involved in this kind of wider field of sustainability, I really started to see how justice, both food justice and environmental justice, are crucial elements of any true work on sustainability. The environmental movement in the United States has a bit of a not great history and reputation of really coming out of affluent white spaces and thinkers, and for many years kind of ignored some of the really dire environmental justice issues that were affecting poor communities in the US, primarily Black and Brown communities. And through work I was doing both for Jewish Farm School and then also at a public school here in Philadelphia running an after-school garden program, I really started to understand that this work needed to be taking a more holistic view of sustainability and include issues of environmental justice and food justice. And then, yeah, I worked for 2 years at this public school running this secular food justice leadership training program for the high school students. And what I really started to realize was that as being someone who grew up in a traditional Jewish home and had a strong connection to Judaism, that our ancestral tradition provides a lot of wisdom and spiritual technologies to help inform our responses to these challenges, and also provides us with a toolkit for celebration, which is an important part of any sort of justice efforts. And so through my work at the high school, I got connected to numerous urban agriculture and food justice projects in Philadelphia. And when I left that job and Jewish Farm School became more of my full-time work, we began to do a lot of work with these other projects. And one of the things that was both inspiring and also kind of validating and affirming was that several of the projects, and often the most inspiring of these projects, were also drawing on some form of ancestral traditions or spiritual practice integrated into the work of sustainability and justice. And so I felt really kind of grounded in doing that work in a Jewish context, even as we reached across race and class and religious lines.
Nati, that's so cool, that intersection. And we want to actually focus on an ancient Jewish tradition, which is the Shemitah year. Right now in our Jewish calendar, we're in the Shemitah year, which is a year of rest for our farms. Can you explain the basic concept of what Shemitah is?
Sure. So Shemitah is one of my favorite things to talk about. I knew vaguely about the concept growing up, but it certainly wasn't emphasized in the Jewish day school I went to. But in college, I for a class on religion, social justice, and urban development, I ended up writing a paper about Shabbat and Shemitah. And that was when I started to do more of a deep dive into it and was just really blown away. So the Shemitah year, the sabbatical year, is the seventh year of a seven-year cycle. And the basic practices are, it's a year of no agricultural activity where we let the land rest and lie fallow. So all land that in the previous 6 years was considered private property becomes commons. One of the practices is that we actually have to take down or open up our fences. We can't restrict access to the lands because we are no longer retaining any claim of ownership over it during that year. All food that grows on its own, which could be wild plants, which could be perennials, fruit and nuts and berries, plants that grow on their own each year without human intervention. Or if you've ever had a garden, you might know that you often have volunteer plants that, you know, your tomatoes fell in the soil the previous year and the seeds have just been hanging out underground for the winter. And then come spring, they start growing up on their own. So any food that grows on its own is ownerless, hefker in Hebrew, and it's available to anyone. And then the final practice is less directly related to the land. And that is that at the conclusion of the Shemitah year, all outstanding debts, interpersonal debts, are canceled. So these are the basic concepts of Shemitah. And I think one of the things that's important to understand about it is, you know, it's often, I would imagine one of the reasons why I didn't really encounter it much, even growing up in Jewish day school and in a traditional Jewish home, is it didn't feel particularly relevant. We were not living in the land of Israel, which is where the agricultural aspects of Shemitah apply. My family, we were not gardeners. So it didn't seem necessarily so relevant. But what I have learned as I've studied more and more about Shemitah, and it's even visible in the first source text of Shemitah. Shemitah appears three times in the Torah. And the first time it says that you shall let your land rest and lie fallow so that the needy among your people may eat. And what they leave, the animals and the wild beasts will come and eat as well, which is a little bit of a counterintuitive kind of cause and effect. We're going to like not farm for a year so that the needy among us may eat. And so as you kind of delve a little deeper into that connection, you start to see that it's not really just a land management practice. It's actually a structural anti-poverty practice that works on some very profound levels within the society, both practically and philosophically, that is meant to kind of ensure longer term sustainability within the society.
So you've described this sustainability as sort of the blueprint, right? Or Shemitah as the blueprint for this sustainable society, as you just hinted at. I know this is something you love to talk about. So tell us more. What does that look like? How does that play out in a way that we can understand?
One of the things that has been a really kind of interesting relearning of some of the more common stories in the Torah, especially throughout the book of Bereishit of Genesis, is I've kind of developed this reading of the text through the lens of both kind of anthropology and agricultural history. And when we start in the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve are placed in the garden with the mandate of to work it and to protect it, what scholars call the stewardship model of human existence. And it is only after they eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil that they're exiled from the garden. And the consequence of their actions are that they're going to have to farm in order to feed themselves, right? By the sweat of your brow shall you eat bread. So one way of understanding that story is that it's kind of an allegory of the agricultural revolution, of people going from being gatherers and living in more of a kind of mutually beneficial caretaking relationship with the land, where just like pretty much every other animal on the planet, you wake up and you say, what am I going to eat today? And you go out and you look for it and you bring it in, you have your needs met, and you do the same thing the next day, the same thing the next day. And hunter-gatherers as migratory people really could not accumulate a whole lot of material wealth because they were moving throughout the seasons to follow the water and the food. When we start to farm, you know, there's some major implications for society as a whole. We can now settle permanently in a place because we can grow a surplus of food and have a abundant food supply all year round. It allows for division of labor. Only a smaller percentage of the population can focus on producing the food, and other people can do everything else. And that's where we see specialization and really civilization kind of emerges out of agriculture. And that there's a lot of benefits to that, but there's also some inherent challenges that are embedded in agricultural societies. And we see that throughout history, both in ancient times and contemporary times. Farming is one of the most exploitative and oppressive industries. And what's interesting is throughout the Book of Bereshit, you know, our ancestors are not farmers. The early ancestors are shepherds. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are shepherds. So they're kind of living on the margins of these emerging agricultural empires of Egypt and Babylonia. And, you know, Abraham kind of travels between these two empires. And it isn't until the famine, when Pharaoh, with Joseph's guidance, has kind of stored all the surplus from the 7 years of plenty. And then there's this 7 years of famine, that all of the citizens of Egypt and Canaan, because that's, you know, the famine is reaching there too, they come to the Pharaoh and they beg for food. And they say, you know, give us seed, give us food, take our money, take our land, take our animals, and eventually take our bodies. We will be your slaves simply so that we can survive. And this is how a tremendous amount of power is consolidated in the palace of the Pharaoh. All of the land becomes the Pharaoh's and all of the resources. And the Israelites, Joseph's family, who are shepherds in Canaan, they come down to Egypt. There's the great reunion. Joseph sets them up in a good spot in Goshen, which is great land for shepherds. And kind of they're sitting pretty there for a while. But then Joseph dies and the Pharaoh dies and their population starts to grow. And we know the story, and the new Pharaoh is threatened by them and eventually enslaves them. So our ancestors, really, their first experience as being fully immersed and part of an agricultural society is as oppressed slaves. And they live in that reality for many generations until ultimately they are freed and wander in the desert. And then when they're going to go and back into the land of Canaan, it's a completely, they're not a family, you know, of 70 people. They are a nation of a million people. And for the first time, they're going to become a nation of farmers. But because of their memory of the experience in Egypt, and that refrain is repeated throughout the Torah, because we were, you know, do not oppress the stranger because we were strangers in the land of Egypt. And that line is often juxtaposed against or right next to numerous Jewish agricultural practices, including Shemitah. We are going to become farmers, but we're going to have a different blueprint for that practice. We are going to farm in a way that preemptively addresses some of these injustices that are inherent in agricultural societies. So, for example, we're designing from the beginning a mechanism for people who are landless or poor or vulnerable to come and get food, right? We have the practice of peah, leaving the corners of our field unharvested, leaving the gleanings in the field and the forgotten harvests in the field for people to come and harvest for themselves. We tithe, we take 10% of our harvest and we donate it to the landless, who are include both the poor and the priests. Because I read this as kind of a check on power consolidation. The priestly class is the one tribe that's not allowed to own land in our tradition. Whereas in, say, in ancient Egypt, you had the priests as part of the Pharaoh's palace owning all of the land, right? So the power gets consolidated. The religious and economic power gets consolidated in one class of people. And in our tradition, we kind of separate that. We have a code about how we treat animals, how we treat workers, the idea of Shabbat, that no matter if you're rich or poor, Jewish or non-Jewish, human or animal, every 7 days, you are entitled to the dignity of sacred rest. And that's a radical idea, right? In an ancient context, no one took days off unless you were part of the elite class. And so this is a really powerful tool of flattening social and economic hierarchies. And Shemitah, and then the practice of Yovel, the Jubilee year, which happens after 7 cycles of 7 years, they really come as, I think of as the pinnacle of this Jewish agricultural blueprint. Whereas some of the other practices are meant to address some of the more immediate needs, right? Of someone who's hungry, they can come and they can harvest the food, they can get the donations, etc. Shemitah and Yovel are structural fixes to some of the challenges of agricultural societies, primarily around disparities of wealth growing too great. So that gets addressed through the practice of debt forgiveness every 7 years, where someone, you know, if they have this opportunity to pay off their debt. And if they're struggling so much that they can't pay it by the end of the Shemitah year, that debt is erased. And it's an opportunity to, it's a fresh start for that person. And it prevents people from falling deeper and deeper into poverty. And the practice of Yovel, of Jubilee, is an even greater economic reset, where in addition to all of the practices of Shemitah, all land returns to its ancestral origin, which means that as the Israelites conquered the land of Canaan, the land was divided up by tribe and within tribe by family. And over the course of 49 years, that land could get bought, sold, traded, etc. But in the 50th year, it's kind of like, I equate it a bit to like playing the game of Monopoly, right? The game of Monopoly ends with one person having all the money and the properties and everyone else bankrupt or in jail. And that is not necessarily the best recipe for a society. And so we have this mechanism where once or twice in a person's life, there's a generational reset, where even if their parents were lousy farmers or made bad financial decisions, they get a fresh start and an opportunity to begin again with equal resources to as everyone else. And so I think of this as, you know, when one of the things that happens when we move from being hunter-gatherers to farmers is, you know, civilization is in many ways a human construct. It's a human design system. And our tradition offers a recipe that says the main goal of our society is that it keeps going indefinitely, right? That is the truest definition of sustainability. We can just keep going. Sure, it'll change and adapt and grow and evolve, but we have mechanisms to make sure that it can keep going indefinitely. And these structural fixes around debt relief and land reform, and also in the Yovel and the Jubilee year, anyone who is a slave or an indentured servant is released and freed. So these are powerful tools to ensure the long-term viability of a just and equitable and sustainable society.
Nati, that was such a sort of, you pulled back the lens, starting with Bereishit and taking us into this amazing view of what was created in our tradition, those fixes that you share that are so necessary, as you can see, for a sustainable society. And I love that, you know, you're bringing this to us, and that clearly we're living in a time when it's the opposite, right, of the world that we're living in and the struggles that we're facing on a big social level. I want us to actually go a little bit narrower for a moment, though, for individuals who are listening to this here in the diaspora. How do we, knowing that, you know, here in the U.S., for example, you know, we're trying to fight for, say, college loan forgiveness or different things, you know, we don't have like a policy for sure around a big debt relief. We know that there are people who work on farms who are being terribly mistreated. There are a lot of big social things that are not being addressed. But how do we, as an individual, take some of the teachings of Shemitah into our own lives and practices?
Yeah, it's a great question because, again, you know, I never encountered Shemitah growing up because I think people felt like that has nothing to do with us. And in fact, I was talking to my father about this. We've been having a weekly chavruta this year on learning the laws of Shemitah. And he was a math professor and he took a sabbatical the year I was born and we went to Israel for the year. And he is an Orthodox Jew, very attuned to halakha, Jewish law. And he said that year was a Shemitah year. And he really has almost no recollection of anything happening in Israel around Shemitah. Like he had no real awareness of it being a Shemitah year. And it's interesting just in the last four decades, how much that has changed. He lives in Jerusalem now. And, you know, there is so much awareness around Shemitah right now, even amongst the non-farmers. And there's some exciting things happening around that. And I think there's kind of a growing consciousness that this is a practice that actually is quite meaningful and important for both society and individuals. So on a personal level, you know, one of the things that's nice about when living in the diaspora, where many of the laws don't apply, the debt forgiveness applies everywhere, which is interesting to note, but the agricultural aspects of Shemitah don't halakhically, technically apply in outside of the land of Israel. So it kind of gives us a lot of flexibility to do what we want with it. We're not beholden to certain practices, even if we have gardens and farms in the US. So we can experiment a bit. And I want to offer a few options for that. So I think there's kind of on a deeply personal, emotional, spiritual, philosophical level, as we learn more about Shemitah, it really challenges some of our notions and assumptions that we have in a capitalist society around our relationship to money, to property, to debt. It invites us to reflect on our relationship to food, community, the earth, in all these different ways. So at a bare minimum, this is an opportunity, this is a year that invites us into a process of reflection on these different relationships. That can happen in very informal ways, that can also happen in more formal ways. There's a lot of educational programming happening around Shemitah. The organization Chazon, which is kind of the largest Jewish environmental organization in the country, they have a lot of resources on their website around Shemitah, including something called the Shemitah Workbook, which is kind of like a journal that people can download and use for processes of reflection. I think there's Rabbi Nina Beth Cardin, who's based in Baltimore. She, for last Shemitah, she started a blog called the Sova Project. Sova meaning enoughness. And she shares this idea that Shemitah gives us an opportunity to rehearse for 1 year what it would feel like for us to live a life of enoughness, to really feel content with what we have instead of always striving for more. We know that a lot of our environmental challenges and the climate crisis is largely driven by kind of endless consumption and growth. And so just like Shabbat does on a weekly basis, Shemitah is an opportunity to say, to pause and say, you know what? I don't have to necessarily be so focused with accomplishing more, building more wealth, acquiring more resources, extracting more from the earth. I can try to shift my mentality into one of enoughness, of contentment. There's a project called the Knapp Ministry, which is inviting people to take more naps and push back on the relentless culture of productivity that we have in our society. And they ask this question, how can you be useless to capitalism today? Disrupt and push back against the system that views you as a machine. You are not a machine, you are a divine human being. And I just love that framing as kind of a mantra, you know, put that up on your wall. And this is a year of trying to be as useless to capitalism as we can. And one common theme that I've noticed among a lot of people is people talk about having like a Shemitah project. They're going to take something on for this year. And for many people, it ends up being about their relationship to technology. right? Technology really infiltrates our lives in many ways, sometimes helpful, often not so helpful. My sister actually just mentioned that her Shemitah practice for the year is that she has removed email from her phone. So when it's time to do email, she sits at her desk, she does it in a more kind of conscious, intentional way. And when she gets up, she's not getting bombarded with messages. You know, that's a very kind of, I mean, it's not so simple actually to do, but it's like a very discreet, tangible thing you can do in the context of Shemitah. Other people are taking on much bigger projects. This is a little bit more of a communal response, but my synagogue here in West Philly, Kol Tzedek, is using the framework of Shemitah to address the issue of medical debt. And there are projects where you can actually buy up medical debt for pennies on the dollar because our healthcare system is so defunct. People are experiencing tremendous crushing medical debt. And, you know, debt gets sold as a money-making prospect. Well, these projects are buying up medical debt and then forgiving them, forgiving the debt. And so Kol Tzedek Synagogue launched a campaign using one of these projects as the platform. And throughout the high holiday season, when many synagogues are trying to raise money for their own budgets, Kol Tzedek raised $40,000, which is releasing $4 million of medical debt because of how that system works. So, you know, there are websites where an individual can make a donation to this, or you can get a small group of people who want to pool some resources and think about creative ways to apply some of these practices in kind of a more contemporary context.
So first, yasher koach to Kol Tzedek. What an amazing accomplishment to do that for our community. The resources you gave us are so helpful. We'll make sure they're available to our listeners so people can do some of their own exploration and perhaps identify their own Shemitah project. I personally am looking at that NAP ministry, all about it. So I'm interested in pursuing that. You know, as we come sort of to the end of our conversation, what would be one key takeaway about Shemitah or about sort of a more sustainable agricultural society that you wish for our listeners today?
I think one of the most important concepts that I understood early on as I started to learn more about Shemitah is that it's not 1 year. It's the seventh year of a seven-year cycle. And just like Shabbat is one day of a seven-day week. And both in whenever, when the commandments around Shabbat are given over in the Torah and the commandments for Shemitah are given over, they both use this same kind of model. 6 days you shall do your work, and on the seventh day you shall rest. 6 years you shall sow your land, and in the seventh year you should let it rest and lie fallow. In other words, they're always in relationship to each other. And what happens is in, you know, the sixth year of the Shemitah cycle, all of a sudden I start seeing a lot more things about Shemitah. Getting emails, do you want to come and speak at this event, be interviewed for this podcast, et cetera, et cetera. And that's great. And I love that there's this increased interest in Shemitah, you know, each cycle as we get closer to the Shemitah year. But we can't really keep Shemitah if we're only thinking about it in the fifth and sixth year. It's kind of like I equate it to deciding at 4:30 on Friday afternoon that you want to keep Shabbat and you've done nothing to prepare. You can do it. You'll get through, you'll survive, but it's not going to be the most enjoyable Shabbat. And some people actually have a practice of every day of the week doing something to prepare for Shabbat. One day you plan the menu, one day you invite the guests, one day you go shopping. So each day you are thinking about Shabbat. It's part of your constant consciousness. So I do think that is an important part of Shemitah. And one of the reasons why when you start to think about, okay, how would these laws actually be applied, especially in a contemporary global economy, it's quite difficult to understand. And that's because we're kind of relating to it as, okay, for 6 years, we're going to be part of this capitalist global economy. And then in the seventh year, we'll somehow detach ourselves from that, still have plenty to eat, still make our economy work, and then we'll just start over again in the seventh year. And that actually doesn't work. What we need to do is design systems where all 6 years leading up to Shemitah are feeding into that and enabling us to keep Shemitah. So you know, for farmers or for a society that wants to adopt Shemitah more holistically, that's a huge heavy lift. We're talking about structural changes and land management practices and planting certain crops in the first and second year so that you, you know, you plant a fruit tree in the first or second year of the Shemitah project and Shemitah cycle so that you'll have fruit by the time the Shemitah year comes. If you plant that tree in the fifth or sixth year, you're not going to have fruit. So that's one piece. But on a personal level, we can also try to relate to each year of the Shemitah cycle throughout those 6 years. A few years ago, some folks I know launched this kind of innovative Jewish calendar. It's called the circle calendar, because instead of a square with many small boxes in a grid to mark out the days, the calendar is designed in a circle, and it's a little confusing to read, but you get the hang of it, and it's got beautiful art for each month. And I noted they started this project, I guess it was the first year of the Shemitah cycle, and each calendar, it says, right on the cover, year one of the Shemitah cycle, year two of the Shemitah cycle, so that we just have this consciousness going at all times. I think that at a bare minimum, what we should try to be doing right now in the Shemitah year is carving out opportunities to reflect on our relationships and our collective priorities. And what can we adjust and make different in the coming Shemitah cycle in order to enact some of those changes by the time the next Shemitah year rolls around? And, you know, we should be visioning really big for what might be possible. We are at a time of great transition. Every day we see headlines around about the climate and weather being kind of the leading news stories. And so we're at this moment as a society and as a species, really, where we're in for a lot of changes in the coming years and decades. And the question is whether those changes will all be reactionary or whether they'll be forward thinking. And I think Shemitah is an opportunity to dream big about what a more ideal and equitable and just society can look like. And then what are the fixes and changes that we need to start making now and to bring to life that new vision.
Nati, you have given us so much to think about and to delve into deeper. So thank you so much for being on the podcast with us today and sharing your knowledge and experience and your insights.
Great. Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, Nati, it was so interesting. And we also want to thank all of you who are listening, who have joined Shomrim and are making all of our work at Jewish Learning Venture possible.
Thank you for joining us on this podcast journey. It's been so much fun. We hope you're enjoying it. We'd love to hear your thoughts about our podcast. Please be in touch and let us know.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, everyone. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.